Okay, so our final subject for today is provisions and contingent liabilities, which is a research project, and Ralat is going to introduce this paper.
Thanks, Hans. So the agenda paper 4 is related to the research project on IS 37, and I will walk through the first few slides to kickstart the discussion. And I will start with slide 3 with the purpose of the discussion today, which is to update you on the status of our research project on IS 37 and to gather your initial views or thoughts on the range of possible problems that we should address and what further research or analysis that we should do in as part of the IS 37 project. On slide 4, we have listed the topics for discussion, and like I said, I'll just walk through the first section of it. The second and third we think could form part of the discussion today. And these three sections are the summary of board papers that is due for discussion next week, and those board papers are provided to you as background information. So I'll start with the project overview on slide 6. The objective of this project is to decide whether or not to take on an active project to amend IS 37. And if we do take up an active project to amend IS 37, what should be the scope of that project? Before we start, we would start an active project, we would like to elicit stakeholder views, and most probably we will do this by way of publishing a discussion paper. We have also provided certain reasons why we consider possible amendments to IS 37. Those are difficulties in interpreting the guidance on identifying liabilities. There are different recognition thresholds that are higher than those for liabilities in other standards. There seems to be lack of clarity on measurement requirements and evidence of some diversity in practice. And lastly, we have noticed lack of guidance on identifying and measuring onerous contracts. On slide 7, we have stated what this research phase would involve. This will primarily focus on gathering information about practical problems in applying IS 37 and in evaluating the implications of the proposals in the conceptual framework exposure draft. We would also like to emphasize that this project is not a continuation of earlier projects, and that there is no presumption that the views will be same as the proposals in the earlier projects. And lastly, this project would trail the conceptual framework project, and therefore ISB is likely to wait until it closes or finalizes the proposals in the conceptual framework before forming any views on IS 37. With this introduction and the summary in the appendix and the background information, there are three questions for you on slide 9. And we may perhaps take up the first two questions together, which is, what do you recommend that we include in the project to amend IS 37? And what aspects do you think needs further research and analysis? So with this, may I hand over to the forum for discussion?
Okay. And I think you missed out the third question.
I thought I'll come later.
You come back to
yeah,
it, okay.
First, we'll first tackle the first two. And
any comments on those first two questions? Slide 9.
You're not going to give us the third one if we say something on the first one.
Okay, I mean,
we'll take that as voluntary, you know.
The question about the which aspects of the cover standards we should include in the project, we would recommend to explore fully the concept of no practical ability to avoid the liability, or as we call it, economic compulsion, because we have seen in practice that sometimes a liability might not meet the strict definition of a obligation, constructive obligation, but as it is now, but companies cannot skip from incurring a liability because otherwise they would be out of business, basically, in many cases, if they don't fulfill some sort of liabilities. I'm not referring specifically to levies, but there are other instances where economic compulsion means that I have an obligation, although it doesn't fit well into the present definition.
Can I ask Alberto a question here? Alberto, do you think that we should link that research or discussion with the notion of going concern? Is there some form of linkage between the assumption of being a going concern at the closing date and taking into account this practical inability or not? Because I see Andreas nodding no, but
not necessarily. I mean, to be out of business, it's the extreme case, not to be a going concern, but not to be able to run the business at the same level, it's, if you don't meet this liability, it happens. I mean, so not necessarily the ultimate going concern, you know. It's being maintaining the same level of profitability.
Clement?
Thank you, Hans. The things that we like, first of all, I think the staff did a very good job in identifying, you know, the problems in IS 37, and the comments like whether that need to be the IS 37 need to be reviewed based on the revised conceptual framework. I think that comment definitely is well received among our members. I think it's essentially important. And secondly, on the identified the inconsistency mentioned in paragraph 1 or 1.1 of agenda 4B, I think again, I think that is something that need to be addressed. On the cost to be included in respect of onerous contract, I think again, you know, we agreed that need to be looked at in order to address the inconsistency between standards. Two other areas that we like to raise it up for your attention. One is about the IAS 11 construction contract, and then the forthcoming IFRS 15. I think if the construction company is need to adopt the IFRS 15 in due course, the inclusion of indirect costs would be a problem. Under IAS 11 now, you know, they need to accrue that, and but under IFRS 15, they it's not clear. So for when the construction company is going to apply 15, when IAS 11 is superseded, then this need to be looked at, maybe in the under the coverage of 37.
Yeah, because it's not IFRS 15 is quite clear. It says you go to IAS 37, and the problem is when you get to IAS 37, that's not clear.
Yeah. So that need to be addressed. Then the other one is on the financial assets 32 and 37 on non-financial assets on the contingency. Financial assets under 32 is quite clear, saying that when you have the amount need could be, you know, sort of identified, then it need to be accrued in the accounts. But 37 contingency, you know, is you cannot accrue in the accounts. You, at the best, you know, if you know the nature, you mention it, you disclose it. So that inconsistency of non-treatment between financial assets and non-financial assets, something that that you might need to look at as well. I think also on the fulfillment value in a conceptual framework, I think again, you know, that is something that you might need to look at. Yeah, I guess for question one, we'll be like that. Okay.
Kim?
Thanks. Well, I guess if you're asking the question about what things should be addressed, I suppose potentially all of the items. I mean, I think, you know, particularly the identifying the liabilities, I really think that there should be some consideration given to aligning the definitions with the revised definition in the conceptual framework. You know, I mean, as you've highlighted, you know, there are, you know, issues with inconsistencies, perhaps with IFRIC 21 and you know, and restructuring provisions. I certainly think there would be a welcome, you know, consideration of those. And then also things like measurement, and I think some of the things in tying with the discounting project that we discussed earlier as well, around what discount rate should be used, you know, what elements should be included, that type of thing. So I think there's some cross-cutting issues. Also the onerous contracts, contingent assets, reimbursements, I think those will all be welcome.
There was one you missed out there, recognition criteria.
Well, we had the discussion earlier around the conceptual framework, and I guess the question is, you know, do we want to reopen this debate now, or whether or not we leave I-37 where it is at the moment?
It's okay.
Pardon?
It's okay.
So, I mean, it's potentially a deviation from the conceptual framework, but maybe we'll still come to the same answer. I do think that other areas need to be addressed, perhaps more than this one.
Andreas?
Thanks. I have a question on the scope. You refer to the scope that's currently the scope of IS37, is that correct? Or is it broader than that? Because a previous project was everything related to non-financial liabilities. Potentially also dive into areas that currently are served by IS12. And the reason why I'm asking is obviously these issues that are currently being debated at the IFRS Interpretations Committee regarding reimbursements. Because if it was an income tax, you treat differently than to a sales tax or whatever. So you could look into IS37 and amend recognition, measurement, what have you, but you could equally look into IS12 and do something there. So,
as part of this project, strictly IS37 and what is within the scope of IS37.
Chris.
So I would agree that there's certainly some fairly fundamental issues with 37. I think Kim went through them. But maybe just to give a bit of flavour, certainly from my perspective, onerous contracts I think are particularly troubling, because I don't think we know the boundaries at which you should be assessing those onerous contracts. If you think about a lease contract, if it's if you're paying above market rent, that could immediately make the lease contract onerous. But generally speaking, we push people back to, sorry, have a look at what the actual cash generating unit at least is, but where do you draw the line? So I do think some work around that, which is not necessarily going to be tied to the conceptual framework, but could be useful. The other one is the contingent assets, because it is completely, I think, inappropriate to have such a very high recognition threshold in that particular area. For things where it's clear that you actually have an asset, but the amount is contingent.
So what sort of thing are you thinking of there?
So the thing I was thinking about is the insurance reimbursement.
Right. So the reimbursement rights rather than the the possible assets.
Yeah. Right. Because I think it's all mixed in together, and again I think you can sort that out fairly quickly without too much trouble. But the other thing that I think people really struggle with is just the general, I think Kim mentioned it, the discounting issue. So I think people are very confused about what to do with risk. Does it go in? If I put it into the discount rate, what do I actually do with it? Everyone's very clear that if you've got risk on an asset side, you add it to the discount rate and it gets a smaller number. On a liability side, what do you do? Presumably it should actually be trying to increase the actual outcome, but I don't think people actually know how to do that. So I think it sort of comes back to the discounting conversation we had earlier this morning. There needs to be better guidance. And even if you're not changing the outcome of what you're measuring, I think you could still provide some better guidance on how to actually do that by either doing your cash flows or doing your discount rate. And if you do your discount rate, this is how you do it. So I think those are kind of the key things. In terms of the other conceptual stuff, I'd rather we tied it in with the conceptual framework so that you are consistent in terms of what you're actually trying to measure.
Yukio.
Thank you. I understand in the past the ISB has experienced significant difficulties in proceeding with a project after it issued the exposure draft in 2005 and 2010, as it met with strong opposition from stakeholders. Having regard to the history of the project, I think that the ISB should take a cautious approach when making judgment as to needs and the scope of the project to revise IS 37, which it considered the standard setting project. On the other hand, we think that consideration of IS 37 would be useful as a test case for the ISB and its stakeholder to understand the possible implications of proposed revision set out in the conceptual framework exposure draft to individual standards, and to consider whether the proposal in the conceptual framework exposure draft is appropriate. So nonetheless, we believe that it's necessary for the ISB to clarify the intended objectives of the project when it launches the initiatives. On various issues, one of the important questions that the ISB previously considered in the project of IS 37 was whether probability threshold should be retained in the standards. That was, discussed in the previous, the session. So we are aware that there are cases where asset and liability should still be recognized, such as the case of derivatives. Even when probability of occurrence is lower, but we think that these cases are relatively limited. Therefore, we still think that the probability threshold should be retained in the conceptual framework.
Chen Chao.
First of all, I agree with the points made by the team and Chris and Clement that I believe that that the issues come from IS 37, most of them relevant to the definition of a liability and recognition criteria and measurement. So all these actually relevant to the conceptual framework. So my point is that we hope that we do conceptual framework first. If the conceptual is clear, relevant to the definition and the recognition criteria and as well as measurement, then it's easier to resolve the issues arising from the IS 37, because many issues actually we discussed relevant to the existing certain uncertainty and measurement uncertainty, something like that. So all these issues are actually relevant to the conceptual framework. So we agree that we can do some research at this stage, but we hope that those issues could be resolved first at a conceptual framework and then come to the details of the revision of the IS-37. With regard to special issues, when we introduced these standards into China several years ago, people are puzzled about the terms and the definition of the provision, contingency, liability, and assets. Because for non-English speaking countries, actually, we very difficult to find the proper words, especially for the provision. What's the meaning of that? What kind of appropriate the terms we should apply? So we hope that maybe in next step we can revisit the terms of the provisions, contingent liabilities, and contingent assets first. And second, it seems that we have adopted different recognition criteria or measurement criteria for assets and liability. So we hope that we can have adopted consistent recognition criteria and mainly based on different, currently we have different probability threshold. We hope that we share same probability adjustment for assets and liability. So yeah, this is my point.
An observation that's relevant to what we might do if we did take up a project rather than to the question of what further research might be needed. And the observation is that while if we were to do something that looked at revisiting problematic areas of IS-37 in light of the conceptual framework once finalized, I want to raise a caution that I don't think we could do a surgical approach. Well, it might be possible to resolve very narrow issues like the discount rate, just going in and looking at the discount rate and then stepping back out. That if we were to look at, let's say, recognition criteria, some of the other aspects, I don't think we could say we're aligning this bit with the with the new conceptual framework, but we're not going to revisit that bit and see if it needs revision to align, because I think right now IS-37, it works or doesn't work together as a whole. If we were to align parts of it but not all of it with the new conceptual framework, I think we would be leaving a legacy of problems for those who had to interpret and apply it. So what I'm coming back to is, if we were to take up a standard setting project, and I think it would have to be after the conceptual framework is finalized, that I think we would have to reconsider all the main decisions, not just the selected problematic ones. We might not have to change them, but I think we'd have to look at them, because we wouldn't want to say, well, this is a legacy from the old conceptual framework, but this piece is from the new conceptual framework, and oh, look, they don't fit together that well.
Clements?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up on Mary's point. I think I totally agree. IS-37 is a 10-year standard, and it got a lot of problems in it. But as far as the practitioner in the market is concerned, I think they got their own ways in dealing with those irregularities or the insufficiencies. And there's no urgent need to amend it. If we are going to amend it, I totally agree that it should be a holistic approach rather than piecemeal. Mm-hmm. And comment made in terms of it has to be done in light of conceptual framework. I think it's a valid comment, but Rebecca was saying earlier, conceptual framework can be a live document. So as far as IS-37 is concerned, I think if it need to be rewritten and amended, it should be done on a holistic basis.
Mm. Did you imply to say that the practitioners like the inconsistencies of...
No, but that's the way to deal with it.
sound more fishy to me. Rebecca?
So I guess overall I'd like to reiterate Clement's comment about the staff paper reflecting, capturing all of the, I guess, challenges we've experienced in the past to provide a good starting point. Very supportive of that analysis. But reflecting that it's been 10 years and using IS-37, and if we do open it, we were of the view that we should be looking at it, shall we say, holistic, reflecting some of the ideas that have been considered from the framework. But given our past experience in the recent last two exposure drafts, in particular in relation to legal claims, that it may be, as what we learned on that last exposure draft, that might be an area where we might be better to separate out that guidance, in essence, move forward the thinking on how we account for other, I'll say, provisions and contingencies right now, and revisit that at a later time. With the one caveat, the paper referred to having talked with practitioners as that they were kind of satisfied that there was a sufficient approach being done for legal provisions. The only thought is to round that off and have a discussion with users to ensure that at this stage they are receiving kind of relevant and sufficient information for their information. But the one part that the more detailed papers focused on was the rationale for what areas you may fix, and it was reflects, I guess, what's in the due process handbook about, in essence, trying to fix the problems, and that leads to efficient and effective standard setting. But from that perspective, we would prefer the holistic approach, as Mary said. If you're looking at the concepts within the framework, you want to know that they're thought through. So if you were doing targeted, you can't pick and choose. But if there was to be a difference, or the scope is to be selected narrowly, the one point we wanted to make sure was that the thinking, if you're not changing provision, the consistency with the framework is identified, and if when it is inconsistent, there is an explanation. The importance of really being transparent of the role of the framework and then what happens at a standard setting level. From a looking at the different categories or the areas that have been picked up on, from identification of liabilities, recognition, and measurement, the one area we wanted to encourage was maybe considering initial measurement and subsequent measurement separately. One of the areas that we've heard of is what if you've done a business combination, for example, and then you're doing your accounting on day two for an asset retirement obligation, 37, you can get differences. And we've heard within certain industries, mining, oil, and gas, that you do get material differences, and there's been diversity. So just wanted to round out that.
Do you see it? I realize there must be differences because there's two different sets of requirements, but I never see them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what, if I'm just not looking hard enough or what I'm doing.
What I can share is that was one of that was a specific issue raised at our IFRS discussion group, and that was from seeing material differences, in particular when there's a bargain purchase gain arises. So I can share that's available within our website, so I can pass on that issue in the discussion that they had. But that was one I wanted to emphasize, given that was a practice.
But when you say initial and subsequent measurement, what are you suggesting we would say about each?
Well, I think it's important is to think through both its which perspective, and what I was highlighting was the business combination example, and I realize that's shifting from one standard to the next, but there are those interactions that I think we need to think through so that there is consistency in accounting and that logic. So that does challenge then the fulfillment approach in considering of non-performance risk.
Andreas?
One further issue that came to my mind is, were you looking to the debit side of the double entry bookkeeping? that is an issue, I mean, that popped up with IFRIC 21. I acknowledge that if you're looking at this from a balance sheet item, it looks odd to look at the other side of the double entry, but nonetheless, I think this is something that has caused tension amongst preparers and auditors and regulators. So it might be worthwhile at least looking into this.
Pat?
A quick question for Rebecca, because I had a similar thought with respect to liabilities related to litigation as a whole. Would you make a distinction between the guidance we develop for legal claims versus the guidance we develop for legal costs, or would you throw them all into one bucket and throw them to the side? The reason I raise this is because, you know, having been a pharmaceutical analyst and looking at a lot of product liability type issues, it's very clear the company can't make an estimate, right? They pull a product from the market, they've got all kinds of class action lawsuits. It's clear they can't give you an estimate day one, even day, you know, 365, sometimes 5 years into it. But they can give you a pretty good estimate, because when that general counsel comes out and says, we're going to fight every action case by case, okay, he can make an estimate, okay, which I think meets the criteria in paragraph 5B. And so the question is that fair game to take off the table as well, as opposed to just the legal claim, which I have no problem with?
But legal costs are not contingent at all. They
that's my view. Right?
They are not contingent.
but many companies make that case and don't, as Jones paper 14B points out, many companies do not accrue for them. Sometimes they make the argument they're not reliably estimable, you know.
But don't you just expense them? Wouldn't that be?
Yeah, I mean, they have to provide.
The lawyers have to provide
the service.
I would just accrue them.
No.
Not if they meet these criteria.
Yeah.
That's relying on management continuing to follow through on that commitment to fight. So they choose at a later time to settle.
Would you say separate those two or throw them all?
I wouldn't think the legal. Potential future legal costs are part of the potential claim settlement. Okay. There, as you incur them, you would expense.
Yeah. Russ?
So I agree with what a lot's been said about the potential scope, and I also agree with the observations of, I would encourage the board to think from an agenda standard setting as a whole, and is this rise to the priority? I know you have an agenda consultation that'll happen this year. I think with respect to Pat Finnegan's last question, I think it would depend, in my mind, on why you carved out legal claims. If you carved out legal claims because of the uncertainty associated with that, in other words, they should, in theory, be treated like other types of contingencies or uncertain measurements, but because they're so uncertain, they get a different accounting. I would think legal costs would also be somewhat uncertain, because there is a trade-off that management will decide to do as to how do you want to constantly hire external counsel, internal counsel to defend, or do you just want to settle? In the U.S., we have a lot of what we call patent trolls. They buy patents and then they sue companies with the understanding that companies would just rather pay $100,000 and have them go away than to litigate and defend the litigation. So there's a little bit of cost-benefit there. If, however, the reason that the litigation claims are carved out potentially is because there is a restriction on the use of specialists, per se, or as we like to say in the U.S., attorney-client privilege, and that while it might be estimable, the auditor wouldn't be able to obtain sufficient evidential matter, then I think that may be a different reason. And if that was the case, I would also think it could be very difficult to estimate your legal costs if the attorney is unwilling to communicate to the auditor what is the actual defense strategy. Now, I don't know, I haven't been able to research, if this attorney-client privilege, which is very important in the U.S. legal system, is there elsewhere. But the way it works in the U.S. is if an attorney tells someone based on their clients, allows them to outside the attorney-client privilege, it is then discoverable for others. And so there is very strict what can and can't be told to third parties. In the U.S., the way it's been dealt with, there's a fancy name, it's in your paper, we refer to it as the treaty. But if you follow the letter of the law, attorney-client privilege is not breached. If you do something else, attorney-client privilege is breached, and once it's breached, it is discoverable. So that's something to think about. Is there some other constraint unrelated to accounting that would prevent the system to work? If so, I would think both would have the same approach.
Okay.
So the third question is, would you be interested in being part of the research and analysis of any of the aspects for future research?
First of all, whether you think there are particular areas where we really need to do a lot more work to investigate these, because it needs more research, and if so, and you may not want to say now, but if if you are interested in helping the benefits, we would be interested to know.
That's all.
We might be interested to do some research. One item which we might investigate further is contingent asset. I'm not this is a personal view. I'm not convinced that in a business combination you should account for contingent liabilities, because ideally you put some sort of value on it, but you discard contingent asset, although you might have, for the same reason, put a value on it. But aside from IFRS 3, there are cases where the boundaries between what is a contingent asset and what is a probable asset is a boundary which is thin, and we might investigate this further.
Okay.
Is that it?
I'm the only one.
Any other things to say about this? No? So then we are done for today.
No, I mean, if anybody has any thoughts on any aspect of this and wants to just send us an email, contact us, just let us know. That would be great. Thank you.